You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. We're at war. There seems to be little question about it. And it's very probable that you are like, Guy, we don't want to be at war. We definitely don't want to be at war. I don't want to hurt anybody. Do you? It's not only a cultural war, it's also a violent war, a physical war. But what do you do if you're the victim of war? What do you do if you're the one attacked rather than the attacker? What do you do if your mother or your child is the one attacked? Do you not fight back? It's painful to say it, but fighting back is not enough. We've got to do more. We're supposed to be converting people, converting them to Jesus Christ. The grand commission from Christ is that we have to go forth and convert all nations. I don't want to arrive there at the end of days and stand there when we're judged and having St. Peter page through his book and come to Chuck Coughlin. And there's two columns. On the left is my lacks and my sins and my incompetences and my clumsinesses and my klutziness. And on the right side, these few good things that I do. I'm afraid that St. Peter, with a sad look, will scan down the Chuck Coughlin page. And then before he reads out what is there, look at me with sad eyes and say this. It says here that Chuck is a kind man. As a matter of fact, a mild man. This in the negative column. Chuck is a very mild gentleman. He would not want to impose anything like his viewpoint on someone else. He wouldn't consider it good manners. He's very tolerant. Very, very tolerant. Perhaps passive. Is a kind man. But he committed the sin of mildness. He was so mild that he never drew anyone, even one inch, toward Christ. Christ didn't want us laying about in the sun. He wanted us to stand up on our hind legs like ambulatory man and speak out. If he gave you a voice, he wanted you to use it. If he gave you a pen and ability to write, he wanted to be able to do that. More than that, he wanted you to set an example. But if you're exhibiting exemplary behavior and no one knows your rationale or for what reason you're exhibiting humane and kind and loving, tolerant behavior, then they'll never realize that it comes from your imitation of Christ. Your very poor, clumsy, klutzy imitation of Christ. You'll have to say so sometime. You might offend somebody. They might do more than be offended. They might come after you. That's what's happening. That's why we're at war, whether we like it or not. ISIS is at war with us. We are guilty of the sin of mildness, of being mild, ladies and gentlemen, so perfect that it's a flaw. We're not supposed to never mention the most precious gift we've ever been given. That like the loaves and fishes multiplies itself if we give it out. It's our Catholic faith. We're not supposed to bury our talents. They're supposed to be part of our Catholic work, our salvation through work. Not bury our Catholic faith. We can't leave out one of the most important links in the chain of converting someone. And that's to describe for them what we are converting them to. And we don't want to fight. But we do want to protect our fellow Catholics. We do want to protect our family. So there is a kind of cultural competition going on. And the other large religion, although it's half the size of Christianity, on earth is Islam. I hear this very frequently. It's said a lot. This statement. Islam is the world's largest religion. Well, the record needs to be set straight. Islam, in its numbers of somewhat over a billion, is only slightly larger than the largest sect of Christianity. The largest sect of Christianity. Catholicism, of course. If you could assess the world's population, a world census, never really been done, you'd find out that one out of six people are Catholics. That's a lot. Islam is composed of many sects just like Christianity. Hundreds more, though, many times more, because there is no authoritative center. Everyone that reads the Quran interprets it for himself. They have their authorities, but they're not analogous, it's apples and oranges, to our theological authorities who have apostolic succession. So Christianity as a whole is about twice as large as Islam as a whole. So for 1,200 years, Islam has been spreading, sometimes very slowly. During some periods, very slowly. Sometimes Muslims are very mild. Sometimes, though, they have ferocious intensity and spread it by the sword or scimitar rather than passively convincing. The scimitar has a blade on it that is indeed convincing. So what does this mean? Well, it means that there has been a long campaign, a jihad, to convert the entire globe to Islam. Currently, the jihad has been very strong, very aggressive, very active, very aggressive, very warlike. It's gone on for well over 1,200 years, 12 centuries. And the pattern is very familiar. It's the jihad. And what we're experiencing now with the massacres in airports, with the destruction of the World Trade Center, with bombs and guns and airplanes used as weapons, it's just one more iteration in a repeating pattern of destruction. The goal in Islam is to set up a ruler, a caliph, who is a global caliph. It's important to have an accurate idea of our situation. It's important to listen. And if you listen, you do know that the goal is a global ruler, a global caliphate, a global emperor, a caliph. We've had a 1,200-year war, a 1,200-year jihad, varying in intensity, sometimes subsiding like a very low tide, sometimes with huge intensity at a very high tide. If you really take an assessment of history, you'll realize that this is not a high tide, it's an intermediate one. It could get far worse, in other words, than deaths of 50 or 100 or 3,000. That's nothing. During one of the early pilgrimages, which is called pejoratively the Crusades by later historians, there were 50,000 people, barefoot, unarmed, Catholics, pilgrimaging to the Holy Land. They were met by a Muslim army in the desert. So a caliph in that location in time sent his army. He equipped them, and they went out in the desert to meet this pilgrimage head on. And they had bows and arrows. They attacked them with bows and arrows. And the Catholics, being unarmed, realizing that they were surrounded, began to die by the dozens and then the hundreds. And they just decided to kneel and to pray to God, to confess, to pray to God for the forgiveness of their sins before dying. There were 50,000 Catholics. It was a big job if they were going to kill them. The bowmen stepped up their pace. They fired their arrows over and over again, killing the old men, the young children, the babies, the mothers, the fathers. The Catholics had no weapons. They had only their hands. And they clasped their hands to pray. Soon the Muslims' quivers were empty. They had killed less than a fifth of the Catholics. So they went to the dead bodies, retrieved the arrows. They wiped the blood off the blades, refilled their quivers, and then lined up again to do the killing more systematically, row by row. It took a half a dozen repetitions of retrieving arrows and filling quivers to kill every last one. And it took a whole day. It was a lot of work. 50,000 in one day. Gives you a little perspective on what we're going through, doesn't it? It's really not so bad right now. No, we're not at a high tide. It's important to know about incidents like that. to give us an idea of what a high tide might look like today. For generations after, travelers in the flat, featureless desert near there would look off and see a mountain. It was a shining white mountain. And as they approached it, they realized that it looked a little unusual. It was composed entirely of human bones. It was a jumble. It was a hill, a quite large hill, almost a mountain, of the bleached bones of all those Catholic pilgrims that died in that one day between sunrise and sunset. For well over a century, that white, radiant hill could still be seen, even from a far distance. Piles of femurs and skulls and of people old and young, of infants, of old women and old men. It was not our choice to go to war. We've been attacked. But it's a very long attack that has never really ceased, the intensity of which goes in and out like the tide since the founding of the Islam religion by the Prophet Muhammad. It is the jihad. Now, we might think that ISIS, as representative of radical Islam, is at a high tide again. No, once you study history, you realize the tide can rush in and flood far higher than that. It's accompanied by mass exterminations, genocide, slavery, and something that I'm going to highlight in this show, destruction of sacred objects and cultures. This is a very old tradition. Perhaps you need a break. I think I'll go get a glass of water and think about something else for a few minutes. And then let's get back together. This is Chuck Coffin, and you're listening to BreadboxMedia.com.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. So how is this war of ours going? Well, a few weeks ago, I guess it was on a Friday, the media reported that ISIS, the Islamist group that has established a caliphate in parts of Syria and Iraq, had destroyed the century-old Tomb of Jonah. The Tomb of Jonah. It was in Mosul, Iraq. They destroyed it. This destruction of sacred cultural objects is, of course, a part of a pattern, blowing up the Silk Road Buddhas. The attempts on the Eiffel Tower that goes on, the World Trade Center. Much as they will try to destroy the Vatican. It's the crown jewel of targets of people that tear things down, of iconoclasts. Now, in Mosul today, you have a lot of interesting archaeological sites. There's the site of the ancient Assyrian capital of Nineveh, where, as you can read in the Bible, the prophet Jonah preached. So he's buried there. Now, some dispute it, but it seems very likely. There's a hill there where he was buried, the hill of the prophet Jonah. Tel Nebi Yunus, which means in English, the hill of the prophet Jonah. Tel Nebi Yunus. Now, an Assyrian church stood over the tomb for centuries. After the Muslim conquest, the church, of course, became a mosque. Muslims were never much for buildings. They were originally nomads living in tents. But it was always possible to get some European slaves who were good architects, or just to take over a church. And redecorated a bit by destroying all the images, of course, plastering them over. That's what happened to the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople, which is now a city that the jihad conquered and renamed as Istanbul, modern-day Istanbul. And the great basilica ordered by the Emperor Constantine, a Catholic basilica, the Hagia Sophia, the House of Wisdom, had mosaics of incomparable magnificence, depicting Christ and the saints, plastered over or chipped off. All the images removed. And this basilica, built under the impetus and direction of the very religiously tolerant Catholic Emperor Constantine, is now a mosque. So this structure that ISIS destroyed last week dated to the 14th century. In addition to the tomb, the mosque once held the supposed remains of the whale that had swallowed Jonah, including one of its teeth. At some point, the tooth disappeared. It was stolen. 2008, the U.S. Army presented the mosque with a replica. Last week, ISIS closed the mosque and prevented worshippers from entering. Then it wired the structure with explosives and blew it to smithereens. There's just rubble there now. Go on YouTube. You can see a video of the explosion. The video was taken by a Mosul resident who mutters in Arabic on the soundtrack. No, no, no. The prophet Jonah is gone. God, these scoundrels. Some commentators have explained the destruction of the tomb as part of ISIS' anti-Christian campaign. Scholars Joel Bodden and Candida Moss pointed out, in Christian interpretation, the Old Testament story of Jonah prefigures the death and resurrection of Christ. They commented that the destruction of his tomb in Mosul is therefore a direct assault on Christian faith and on one of the few physical traces of that faith remaining in Iraq. Another scholar, Sam Hardy, told the Washington Post that the destruction of the tomb shows that ISIS is willing to destroy pretty much anything in the Bible. On this analysis, ISIS destroyed the tomb because of its Christian associations. But one reporter believes that mistakes ISIS' motives in this case. ISIS has no respect for Christians or their sites of worship, and in fact has driven Muslims, Christians away out of the city. The fact that the tomb was sacred for Christians, for Catholics, as well as Muslims, and contained a present from the U.S. Army. Think of that, a present from the U.S. Army. Cannot have endeared it to ISIS. But something else is going on here, the reporter writes. The shrine was, after all, a mosque, and Jonah figures in the Quran as well as the Bible. To understand why ISIS destroyed the tomb, one has to appreciate something about the version of Islam the group espouses. ISIS is part of the Salafi movement, a branch of Sunni Islam that seeks to return to the practices of the earliest Muslims, the Salaf, who lived at the time of the Prophet Muhammad, and just after, of course, for several generations, the Salaf. The movement rejects the centuries of subsequent developments in Islam as unjustified innovations, pagan accretions that adulterated the faith. In particular, the movement opposes the veneration of the graves of Islamic prophets and holy men. Salafis see this practice, which is associated most frequently with Sufi Islam, as a kind of idolatry or shirk, S-H-I-R-K, shirk, that detracts from the absolute transcendence of God. Salafi Islam prevails in Saudi Arabia, where it enjoys the patronage of the royal family. On the Arabian Peninsula, as now in Iraq, Salafis have destroyed the tombs of Islamic holy men all over the place. When the Saudi royal family captured the city of Medina in the 19th century, Salafis systematically destroyed the tombs of several of the Prophet Muhammad's companions and family members, leaving only the Prophet's tomb itself unmolested. There is some speculation that the Saudi government plans on dismantling even that tomb. But evidently they hesitate to do so because of the uproar that would result in other Muslim communities. In short, one should see ISIS's destruction of the tomb of Jonah as an act principally directed at other Muslims, not Christians. That doesn't make it any better, of course. Will the outside world do anything in response? Well, that's not too likely. Besides, as Professor Hardy told the Washington Post reporter, if we didn't intervene when they were killing people, it would be kind of grotesque to intervene over a building. Well, sometimes a building is not just a building, is it? Sometimes material objects have transcendental meanings. It's something about the way the human spirit and mind works that understands that. You know, I want to make a comment from my personal attitude toward relics of these ancient tombs and sites, that we should be less skeptical than we are. I went to a Catholic school. Many of us went to Catholic schools. But still, we absorb the Protestant skepticism about relics and even ridicule of relics. The United States has a Protestant ethic and attitude toward things, which we sort of pick up by osmosis. But that ridicule is very misplaced. Authentic relics have passed many, many tests of authenticity through the ages, and careful documentation was kept in earlier times, who valued the authenticity of relics perhaps even more highly than we do. Perhaps you, like I, were raised Catholic, but we were raised Catholic in a Protestant environment. It was traditional from the Protestant Reformation in the 1500s on to ridicule relics and treat them all as fantasy, such as particles of the true cross. Yet the likelihood is that these things are authentic. The Catholic Church has always carefully assessed the validity of relics, and their chain of custody has to be solid before it's considered to be likely so, even likely so. But people in these ancient times were very, very careful about preserving relics and the chain of custody in authentic documentation. Do I think that Jonah was buried in that hill? More likely than not, that's what I think. If I may be a bit daring, I'll state a proposition, another daring proposition. Where the jihad goes, iconoclasts are there. Destruction is there. Such terror and destruction tactics are nothing new. They've been standard practice in the conquest of the medieval Islamic caliphate. The Muslim historian Ibn Khaldun describes how an Islamic commander devastated his enemy in Greek Catholic North Africa. Hassan, this is the Muslim commander, Ibn al-Numan, Hassan attacked Carthage so violently that the Greeks were forced to flee, some to Sicily, some to Spain. Hassan, having entered the place, did nothing but pillage, kill, and take slaves. He sent detachments to the surrounding areas and gave orders to demolish the city. Muslims, destroying everything that they could, learned that some Greeks and the Berbers had reassembled at Satfora. The Muslim leader attacked them and killed large numbers. The inhabitants were desolated. Wait till you hear what I have to tell you now. The Abbasid Caliph Al-Ma'mun, who died in 833, attempted to destroy the Great Pyramid of Giza. This illustrates another tactic, it's a terror tactic, of the Islamic conquest, the destruction of the enemy's monuments. Because this also destroys their will. It demoralizes. Very successful tactic. It takes something from their soul to destroy their monuments. Thank God Caliph Al-Ma'mun did not succeed. He was trying to destroy the Great Pyramid of Giza. This destruction of these monuments and destroying the aspirations and cultural heritage of people was prompted not only by the religious teachings of medieval Islam. All constructions of a pre-Islamic past that may overshadow in their beauty or height Islamic buildings, or that have religious representations, they call them idols, must be destroyed. Of course, these monuments and images are considered sacrilegious, but that's not the only reason. They destroyed for the demoralizing effect it has on the people who are the infidels, the non-believers. So why don't we break down? Setting the record straight, this is Chuck Coughlin.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. Thanks for being here with me after the break. We were talking about the jihad, and the Muslims need to destroy. And there were quite a few reasons. The feeling that image was a sacrilegious part of it. But what about buildings? Well, sometimes the buildings that they took over were so magnificent that they would compete with anything that the Muslims could build for themselves. The thought of preserving something from a foreign culture, because it was magnificent, beautiful, and artistically executed, was not in their repertoire of feelings. And the need to eliminate any non-Muslim monument that might compete in greatness with a Muslim ruler's constructions, his new constructions. Another dramatic example is the successful demolition by Harun al-Rashid. He's the celebrated caliph of the 1001 Nights. He destroyed the extraordinary palace of the Persian king Khosra, sometimes called Kasra. This was in the 500s. And done in the once great Persian city of Ctesiphon, where Al-Mandain, Iraq, stands today. Several medieval Muslim historians, and at least one medieval Catholic historian, a Coptic, state that the Great Library of Alexandria was burned with the permission, or by the order, of the second caliph. This was 642. The second caliph's name was Umar, U-M-A-R. And he ordered it destroyed during the Muslim conquest of Egypt as part of a long lament over the loss of the sciences of the ancients, except the sciences of the Greeks, thanks to the Caliph Marwan I and the money he spent to pay Christian translators. Ibn Khaldun writes that the sciences of the Persians were destroyed by Caliph Umar's orders and that the celebrated Sultan Saladin the Magnificent, destroyed the libraries of his heretical Muslim enemies, the Fatimids. I know that's a lot of names, but it's sort of interesting. And people who speak Arabic, I beg your pardon, I do much better with the European languages. I really haven't studied Arabic. I'm doing the best I can. You know, the Caliph Harun al-Rashid of the 1001 Nights is celebrated in this famous collection of mostly Persian and Indian tales, which are written in Arabic, but they're really borrowed from other cultures. A very interesting fact about Islamic culture is the more that you look at it and look at the sources of it, a great deal of it seems to be borrowed or stolen during destructions. But you'll never learn that from the politically correct academia that inhabits our universities. Other Islamic sources confirm such terror tactics during the conquest of the mostly pagan, but some were Catholic, Berber tribes in North Africa. They tell of battles of extermination against the Berber tribes, after which other Berbers, terrified at what happened to those who resisted, submitted to Musa and asked to convert to Islam and join the victorious Muslims. The abundant loot obtained along with huge numbers of slaves of both sexes, enticed the faithful from all over the realm of Islam, the Ummah, to flock to North Africa to join Musa's successful armies. Musa was a warrior too. He fought along with his troops. He fought battles of extermination. He killed myriads of them. He made a surprising number of prisoners, to say nothing of the camels, cows, sheep, horses, mules, grain, and articles of dress. After this, Musa and his men returned with their prey, all these forays taking place within the year 80. That's actually around 700. And when the soldiers of distant countries inhabited by the Muslims heard of the success which God had granted to Musa's arms and the immense spoil collected by the men under his orders, they all wished to go to Western Africa. Musa's army being soon reinforced by numbers, which increased it to double its original form. Are you noticing the somewhat formal language in the construction of the text that I'm reading from? It's a history book. I'm reading from the writings of a historian of the time. I'll go on. Quote, after one battle, innumerable maidens, inestimable by their beauty and accomplishments, and the daughters of the kings and chiefs were on this occasion the prize of the victors. When the spoils gained in this battles were to be divided, Musa caused the daughters of the kings to stand before him, and having sent for his son Mardwan, come, O my son, come and choose among these maids. And Mardwan chose among them one that was the daughter of their late king, and who afterward became the mother of two sons by Mardwan. So that's a passage from a historian of the time. We also read that the number of captives taken by Musa was greater than in any previous Islamic conquest. The historian goes on. He writes, Musa went out against the Berbers and pursued them far into their native deserts, leaving wherever he went traces of his passage, killing numbers of them, taking thousands of prisoners, and carrying on the work of havoc and destruction. When the nations inhabiting the dreary plains of Africa saw what had befallen the Berbers of the coast and of the interior, they hastened to ask for peace and place themselves under the obedience of Musa, whom they solicited to enlist them in the ranks of his army. That's what the historian wrote. There's a Spanish expert in the Arab world, Pascual de Guayandus, who wrote, owing to the system of warfare adopted by the Arabs, it is not improbable that the number of captives here specified fell into Musa's hands. It appears from both Catholic and Arabian authorities that populous towns were not infrequently razed to the ground, and their inhabitants, amounting to several thousands, were led into captivity. Al-Hakam relates that the Muslim leader Hassan had captured, in the words of a contemporary of Hassan, young female Berber slaves of unparalleled beauty, some of whom were worth 1,000 dinars. Al-Hakim confirms that up to 100,000 slaves were captured by Musa and his son and nephew during the conquest of North Africa. In Tangiers, Musa enslaved all the Berber inhabitants. Musa sacked a fortress and took with him all the children as slaves. There's a book, the Byzantine Arabic Chronicle of 1743, which is slanted quite toward Islam's consistently friendly writing, and it records similar Muslim shock and awe tactics in Greek Catholic North Africa. Muslim commander Habadallah reached Tripoli, and with his army he attacked Sidamo and Leptis Magna, and having destroyed many cities, he subjugated to Saracen power all these devastated provinces. Afterwards, still thirsty with blood, he moved on, and all the armies of the Mauritanians fled, and all the nobility of Africa, with Greek Count Gregory at its head, was completely annihilated. Then Habadallah, abundantly loaded with treasury, returned to Egypt. I'm giving you somewhat detailed accounts that are indicative of what went on at all times and all years. The historical events of the first 500 years of Islam cannot be ignored, even though they are so often by academics in describing the character of Islam in the modern world. Muhammad's wars against the infidels in the Arabian Peninsula and Islam's impressive conquests well beyond the Arabian Peninsula, including much of Spain, were made possible not by a peaceful inner struggle, but by a bellicose and outward one. Learned medieval ulama and Muslim military leaders associated war against infidels with a sacred duty, thereby turning war into an inseparable part of a Muslim's religious life. War, sacrifice, and martyrdom became part of the religious cultural ethos of medieval Islam. In this association may reside much of the early success of Islamic imperialism. As the historian Marabia observes, what for pre-Muslim Arabs had been simply razzia, lightning raids against other Bedouin tribes, under Muhammad became holy war. That's with a capital H and a capital W. Under Muhammad became the innovation, holy war. Just not a lightning-like raid to kill a few people and steal things. Although Muhammad began his career robbing and killing people in desert caravans. So what for nations outside Arabia had been merely war became for Islam under Muhammad's successors a perennial holy war. Other religions and nations remained at a disadvantage when confronting the highly motivating Islamic religious concept of jihad as holy war. Now it is true that Catholic Spain did successfully turn its war of Reconquista, of reconquest of its own territory against Islam, into a religious war of its own. That was in the 13th century. A crusade, it was called. But even a crusade, as historians have observed, never could have the same internalized degree of everyday spiritual obligation that Islam Jihad as holy war achieved. So the politically correct academics who try to equate jihad with the Catholic Crusades are proposing an idea that simply does not withstand any kind of in-depth analysis. For devout Catholics, the sacred war of a crusade was a unique event that only a pope could proclaim, and it was a one-time event for these people. As some of the greatest historians of the period have pointed out, for devout Muslims, the sacred war of the jihad was a permanent state of being, decreed by Islamic law that the caliph must wage war at least once a year. Therefore, it was a permanent war. Jihad was a permanent state of being. I hope you understand that I'm bringing forth a few events or a few conquests out of thousands that occurred over centuries, out of a perennial state of war. These weren't occasional events that we're accustomed to when we think of the intermittent wars of Europe. The jihad is a perennial and persistent, a constant state, a permanent state of war. And it does exist today. We may not know it, but we're at war, as I said at the beginning of the program. We'll break for a moment. This is Chuck Coughlin.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. In this program, we're setting the record straight about the real nature of the jihad, which has been so obscured by today's politically correct academics, who claim that the jihad was simply an expansion or done for material gain, or a most peculiar explanation, that it's simply an inner struggle, an inner spiritual night of the soul. There's very little evidence for that. Now we can return to examining the evidence for the religious motivation of the Muslim conquest of Spain. In downplaying religious motivations for the Islamic invasion, some Western academics make much of the fact that the earliest Catholic chronicles narrating the conquest refers to the invaders as Saracens rather than Muslims. Well, the truth is that Saracen was a Roman name, a Latin name for Muslims. They're the same thing. The idea that it's just an expansion, like migratory wave of people going to a new area, or an exertion like those of the Spaniards in the Americas, the French in Algeria, the Dutch in South Africa, more examples, the British in India and the Belgians in the Congo. A colonization. Well, there's real problems with that argument once you examine it closely. First, it overlooks the fact that Muslim chronicles of the Muslim conquests themselves portray jihad as holy war, not as peaceful individual struggle, not as peaceful individual struggle or exertion for self-improvement. And that the Andalusian Muslim leaders saw their wars against Catholics as holy wars as well. The chronicles usually identified the invaders as Muslims and the Catholics as idolaters or polytheists and infidels. Or they used the term Rum, R-U-M, their word for Romans. But the Rum, in their case, were inhabitants of the Catholic Greek Roman Empire. There's a historian, Al-Qutayya, who's of Visigoth ancestry. In around year 1000, just before the year 1000 anyway, he narrates how one of the Muslim commanders was inspired by his dreaming of Muhammad and his companions with their drawn swords entering Spain. The same commander, Tariq, is portrayed haranguing his men before battle by reminding them of the religious benefits of martyrdom earned in a jihad. The They describe another great leader as a courageous champion of jihad, frontier warrior, intrepid and valiant, burning in his desire to hurt the polytheists. Well, polytheists are Catholics who believe in a three persons in one God, the triune God. They saw this as polytheism. There's a 12th century historian, Al-Qardabis, who highlights the religious fervor of the invaders. This is a Muslim historian, by the way. The Muslims fought with bravery, he writes, and they charged intrepidly like one man against the polytheists, whom Allah had abandoned and whose legs he would make tremble. They usually refer to the enemy Catholics as infidels in politics and polytheists, and to the conquerors as, quote, the Muslims. But there's a more significant proof of this. These armies were always accompanied by a group of men who were called the Tabium. And these were old wise men who were had an apostolic succession. They were of the second or third Muslim generation who knew at least of one of the companions of Muhammad. The companions of Muhammad are a very special inner group. That's a capital C, the companions of Muhammad. And so these men were in charge of supervising the proper Islamization of a conquered land and the establishment of the first mosques. That was another feature of the early jihads. These were very consciously, religiously motivated wars, a jihad against infidels, not a peaceful means of perfecting or exerting themselves spiritually. Probably the most brilliant military mind among the rulers of Islamic Spain was a man named Al-Mansur. And he could have justified his burning of Catholic cities with Maliki Islamic teachings and it's made clear that burning the towers of infidel was allowed in jihad. So was flooding them and, quote, cutting their trees and their fruit, killing their animals and destroying their buildings, and all that can be broken down. So motivated by religious zeal, Al-Mansur ordered all philosophy and logic books in Cordoba publicly burned. All those books were publicly burned. These subjects, observed the Muslim historian Al-Andalusi, remained proscribed afterward, forbidden in the Taifi kingdoms. Although it is said their rulers fostered such common arts as poetry and grammar, Al-Mansur was so devoted to holy war that in a single year he sent 5 expeditions against the Catholic kingdoms. He demolished the entire city of Leon with the exception of a tower. He left the tower standing so that the thickness of its walls later generations could appreciate the accomplishment involved in his victory. Muslim leaders punished any apostasy with death. The second problem with the idea that the jihad is not religiously motivated does center around the use of the Greco-Roman word Saracen rather than Muslim in a lot of the chronicles. But I think we've already laid that to rest. It's just a synonym. And academics have often marveled at the speed at which the Islamic conquests took place. Although this is not that exceptional, really. It was not faster than other rapid victories in the history of war. The Greek warriors of Alexander the Great conquered a much stronger foe of the Persian Empire in less time. The Mongols and Tartars of Genghis Khan and Tamerlane carried out comparable conquests, including the crushing defeat of Muslim armies in the Middle East, in an even shorter time. So it's no mystery. Both Muslim and Catholic sources attest that the Islamic forces were just more ruthless and knew how to demoralize an enemy better than any army since the Roman conquest. Both Muslims and Catholic sources mention a story that, even if apocryphal, illustrates the knowledge of the tactical use of terror in psychological warfare. They were terrorists. They're with us today. This story illustrates the tactical use of terrorism. Shortly after the Islamic forces landed, the flesh of the cadavers of some Catholics killed in battle were boiled in large cauldrons under the sight of terrified Catholic prisoners, who became convinced that Muslims were cannibals. The Muslims then set loose the prisoners, who, as Al-Qarabas, the historian, says, told every Catholic they met what they'd seen, and so that Allah filled their hearts with panic. And afterwards came the battle against the Spanish king, King Rodrigo. The Muslim historians write that Musa sacked, enslaved, and spent 3 years waging jihad against the Spanish infidels. Musa spent as much time pillaging as organizing the conquered land. These sources also mention that several members of the Tabian, that's the group of wise old Muslims who were direct disciples of Muhammad's companions, several members of the Tabium entered Spain to direct the jihad and the conversion of the land. The presence of these members of the Tabium underlines the fundamental religious motivation of the invasion. Wherever and whenever Catholics would resist, after the Muslims were victorious, a massacre would follow. In some places, the defeated Catholics were punished with extermination. After the Muslims took Cordoba in Spain in a furious assault, the remaining Catholic defenders retreated to a church in order to continue fighting. According to an authority, the Muslims put the building to the torch, and the Catholics inside died without surrendering. The few Catholics that surrendered, the Muslim commander had them beheaded. Thus, the Muslim commander left Cordoba in the hands of the Jewish community. Now, Toledo was a capital of the Visigoths, and it offered no resistance to the rapid advance of Islamic forces, because most warriors had marched with King Rodrigo to meet the enemy. Nevertheless, Musa executed some aged Toledo nobles for reasons that scholars do not agree on, but perhaps it was just to terrorize everyone else. So they left the Jews, accompanied by a certain number of Muslim warriors, in charge of Toledo and moved on to Guadalajara. The Muslim forces captured Seville after a siege, sending the Catholic warriors flee to the north. Again, they left the Jewish community to guard the city. In front of Merida, the Islamic forces followed a victory with a massacre of the fleeing polytheists. Back in Seville, the inevitable happened. The Catholics revolted against the occupiers, the Muslim Jewish garrison, and a reinforced Muslim army retook the city and massacred the inhabitants. In Granada, the conquerors also left the Jewish community in charge. A certain enmity arose that seems to explain when, after the completion of the Reconquista, hundreds of thousands of Jews were expelled from Spain, who had lived there for centuries in a peaceful coexistence among the Catholic communities under Catholic rulers before that. Apparently, the Muslim rule included the tactic of divide and conquer, with tragic consequences later. I hope we've set the record straight. This is Chuck Coughlin on BreadboxMedia.com.